My guest today is Lawrence Halprin, a landscape architect and urban planner. He and his firm evolved a style that brings a sense of the great outdoors back to crowded and dirty cities in startling ways, as Levi Plaza Park in San Francisco transports the feel of a high Sierra stream flowing through a meadow and granite boulders to downtown. So persuasive is his design that birds and dragonflies have returned to the area. Visitors to San Francisco may know his work, Ghirardelli Square, finished now 20 years ago, where people move around fountains, stores, and plazas in the former chocolate factory. Halprin's work there and at Sea Ranch on the California coast, in Minneapolis and Portland, inspired other planners to rethink how public places are designed. His plan for the park, now covering part of a Seattle freeway, uses rushing water to wash out the sounds of the Interstate 5 traffic beneath it and brought back to life a part of the city the freeway had killed. Lawrence Halprin has worked in his own large firm, and now at the age of 72, heads a small atelier which still designs projects in this country, such as the Bunker Hill Steps in Los Angeles, and abroad in Jerusalem and Florence. Part of planning for a space, whether it's a backyard or a street or a coastline, is to see what's there and how it's used. I wondered what Halprin looks out for when he first comes upon a space he's been asked to change.
In the field that I'm in, there are always two things or more that affect what I do and how I think about things. Very often, the first thing I do is get an intuitive sense about things. When I walk through it, I try to empathize about how it feels. It's like meeting somebody at the very beginning. When you first meet somebody, some of the most powerful images that you maintain, even though you know them for years and years afterwards, is that first impression of what they look like, how they move, how they sit, how they smile, how you feel about them, even in a funny way, how they smell. I don't mean that literally. And it isn't analytical at the beginning. It's completely intuitive. And you might say aesthetic is the wrong word, but it's anthropomorphic, in a sense. Then the next thing I try to do is to think about how it functions. Then I become much more analytical. How are people using this street? What do they want from it? Is the traffic moving up and down? How are the spaces themselves? How high are the buildings around it? How is it functioning in the city? What is its context? And then I try to put them together and say, okay, between these two things, how are we poetically and aesthetically what are we going to try to make of this place so that it improves both, that it maintains its sense of place as a person, as a place, and then also how can it function better?
You developed your own system for taking notes and projecting behavior in a space called motation. What does that word mean, and how does motation work?
Well, the word motation is a made-up word. It's a synthetic word that I put together from notations, which are like musical notations or sketches, and motion. And because in all these places that I design and that I'm always in and involved in, I'm always thinking about how people move through it, how their lives are influenced by it, which are non-static, not visually so much, because that's rather easy. But how, as you move around, you see this, you see that, you encounter people, you encounter things. And so the two words came together in a term called motation. And the motation system, which I developed, gives me a tool by which I can put this material together in graphic form so that I can look at it and study it. It's a form of architecture in motion, you might say, or architectural drawing in motion. And
this sounds very akin to dance choreography.
It's exactly the same as dance choreography. In fact, there are systems. My wife, as you know, is a dancer, and one of the early reasons that I put together this motation system was that she asked me at one point to choreograph some dances for her and to make them visible so that we could teach other people to dance with her. And I was doing the stage sets as well, and so I developed this system of graphically delineating what people would do in a stage, on a stage, with costume and so forth. And this developed the idea of motation, which I have since applied over and over again to cities and transit systems and pedestrian ways and so forth.
I get the sense that you view a space in which people move throughout the day as theater.
Well, sure. Theater, when I say sure, I suppose I should say yes. But if it seems to me so inherently humanistic to say yes, of course, because people are constantly in motion, and they are doing things constantly in their lives that not only are functional but are ritualistic and mythical things which are communicating always with other people, with their environment, and that's how I perceive everything that I do in new work and in the conservation of old work.
You played baseball as a young man. Were you good enough to think about being a professional?
Oh, yeah. I think one of the great questions that will remain with me for the rest of my life, I was going to go up with the Dodgers.
We're talking Brooklyn Dodgers here, right?
That's the only kind of Dodgers there are, for heaven's sakes. And that was after prep school, and I was going up as a pitcher. And at that moment in time, I decided instead to take the adventure of going to Israel, and I did. And when I came back 3 years later, it wasn't so much that I'd lost it, but I was less interested in becoming a professional baseball player.
I look at a baseball diamond, and I see that as a piece of landscape architecture that has choreography within it. There's a set of rules that people follow. Is that similar to what you try to do with a space? You set up rules by putting in furniture, trees, bits of water, ponds, curving paths. Do you try to set up rules for people who use a space?
Yes and no. I think what I try to do instead of setting up rules is set up opportunities. And in that sense, it's a little different than a game. I try to, in the spaces that I use, and bear in mind that I'm also dealing with plazas which have no, often as Venice, or what we're doing in Florence, these spaces are mostly spaces. They're like great outdoor rooms without cover, without a top, often with no plantings at all, but beautiful pavings, benches, sculpture, fountains, and so forth. And the main thing I try to do is not so much set up the rules as because those are built into the environment itself, but to make opportunities more available for people, make it possible for people to enrich their lives through it. Do you follow the difference?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that interests me more because rules are man-made and opportunities are human-made.
Is there a natural example that you use as sort of your main working metaphor for these natural opportunities? Is there a place in the world that's always inspired you to which you return? Where is that?
I have two sources that inspire me and have a lot to do with my work. One is the High Sierra, and natural phenomena like the High Sierra, where when you spend time up in the High Sierra, you see the very source of both humanity and how people react to nature, because there, up in those high mountains, erosion forms create landscapes that are ineffable in their poetry and their beauty. You can see the same kind of thing in the Southwest, where the great mesas and the structures that are built on them become organic. They become linked to nature in the sense that the difference between the man-made phenomenon and the nature-made are so similar because of the attitude in which they were built that you can't tell the difference between the two. One enhances the other. That's one source. The other source for me is the incredible sense that art can bring into human life. Art in the sense that great artists like Michelangelo in our own time, some of the great architects like Richard Rogers and Jim Sterling and others can bring to people, where they produce for people through their ability to imagine the poetry that will emerge out of what they make, the painting, the sculpture, how those things can enhance people's lives. And so when, as I think about things, I think about both. Nature as a great poetic manifestation of the universe and how the land has become on its own, and then the artistry that great artists can bring to all our lives.
You worked in a kibbutz in Israel as a young man. How did this change your sense of how people work together?
Well, let's see. It's not so much how people work together that influenced me on a kibbutz. I worked on a kibbutz between prep school and college for 3 years. It was one of the deeply important experiences of my life. It had a lot to do not only with how people live together and work together, but also on the whole basis of a value system in life. It influenced my point of view about the value of labor, of work, of how making things with your own hands is important, how about the idea of non-competition in the sense of what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours, but the opportunity that people have when living in a community of that kind to share. It profoundly affected my deep-seated belief in democracy, because in a kibbutz, no one person is more equal than any other person. Each one has a vote. In fact, they rotate management to the point that everybody is always involved in all aspects of a kibbutz. And so, in a sense, I saw in action a utopian point of view, in action, a way which, in a profound sense, has a lot to do with some of the utopian communities that were here in America in the middle of the 18th century, of the 19th century, 100 years ago. And even now, if you go down to the Southwest and see some of the Native American communities, has a lot to do with their point of view as well. That is, that nobody owns any land. Land is something that is God-given's a gift to humanity and to the people who are occupying it, that you can't sell land. That's a point of view that the kibbutz has, and which Native Americans have.
I think
funny way I believe in too. So, and on all kinds of levels, it affected my point of view about life in general.
Uh-huh. One of your projects in Portland is the Lovejoy, the Fountain and Plaza area, which makes a great use of water. And in fact, a lot of your projects make use of flowing water, waterfalls. What for you is important about the use of water in public spaces? How do people react to it?
Well, people seem to react to it on a number of levels. One is on the pure joy of involving themselves with it. Particularly, children like to climb in it and splash in it. But there's another basis on which people love to use and be involved in water, and that's a biological level. We come from water. Water is at the essence and the core of our existence. On a biological level, most of our bodies, as you know, are water. Our ancestors came out of the water, and for all kinds of water reasons, water is life giving. It is at the core of how we live, and for that reason, people empathize with it in a profound way that goes way beyond function. The liveliness of water in a city becomes extremely important as well, because it has sound, it splashes, it's cooling, it moves, and for all of those reasons, people just love water and enjoy it, and I love to bring it into the city because it is a life-giving, enjoyable thing for people to involve themselves in.
Part of your vision for the Portland Project was that children would play in it, but I understand
Absolutely.
The city of Portland didn't want the children to play in it, and you had to take them to court?
No, that isn't true.
But there was some
myths.
Is that a myth?
Yeah.
What happened in Portland?
They were surprised, but I didn't have to take anybody to court.
Uh-huh.
At the very beginning, I explained that what we were trying... You must bear in mind that the first fountains that I, in a sense, were ever designed for people and children particularly to be allowed to go into happened in Portland. And in that sense, it was groundbreaking, or maybe we should say waterbreaking. And for them, it was a surprise that instead of having signs around saying, stay out of the water, or stay off the grass. We encouraged people to come into it. At the very beginning, they were a little surprised that I was delighted and wanted people to come in. The first day that we turned on the first fountain there, the Lovejoy, thousands of people came and started playing around in the water, and they were startled about it. And it was simply a matter of my saying to them, this is exactly what we wanted and what we intended, and that was that. We didn't have to go to court at all.
Well, that seems quite the obverse of what happens to a lot of public spaces, where a city will decide to put in, we need some open space here, let's put in a giant plaza, and it becomes a windswept, barren desert rather than a place through which people want to move.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, things change, and one of the things that pleases me about Portland and some of the early work in Portland is that it has become almost accepted by now in cities that plazas have a life of their own, which are devoted to people's enjoyment and use, and that water and people's involvement in it is something that you ought to plan for. So I think that although what you said could perhaps have been the case 30 years ago, by now almost every plaza that we're involved in, or many, many other people are too, the understanding that citizens have, and for that reason the Board of Supervisors or City Councils, is that a plaza ought to do for the city all the things that you spoke of, and that which I wish also, and that is that they become a center for the city, a center of life and enjoyment, and a place which for the public becomes more than just one thing, but symbolic of the whole city.
Who are all the different people that you need to incorporate in planning for a project? You've developed a technique called taking part, some RSVP workshops. What goes on in these? Who are the kinds of people that you invite to help you plan a public project?
It depends a great deal on what the project is, of course, but one of the major things that groups of people that we use are users, are the people who are going to either live there or use it or somehow be involved, not on a casual and external basis from somewhere else, not experts, but the actual people themselves who are going to be involved in its use, maintenance, and for whom the place is enhancing their lives. A recent workshop that we just did, for example, involved a group of people, 100 people or more, for the island of Alcatraz, which we had been commissioned by the Golden Gate National Parks Association to try to evolve not only a design for, but also to take and evolve a philosophical attitude about how should it be used, what should it be, what should it include, and how should it become something that all the people of the Bay Area and for all the country would be interested in. We involved many, many different people with different attitudes, biologists, anthropologists, scientists, individual people, users of different ages, so that we would get an overview idea of what all the people, as many as we could, would feel good about as we started our designs for Alcatraz. That's the point of view that we always take in these workshops, and that is as many people who are deeply and emotionally and functionally going to be involved in a place can participate with us in determining what's going to happen.
Pictures I've seen of these workshops have long lines of people on their hands and knees writing on long scrolls of paper. What is this part of the procedure?
Well, the reason for that is this. My point of view about the environment, as it is the fundament of life itself, is that many different senses and ways of communication are extremely important for people in their attitudes about and their contributions to designs of places. That talking about something is just one particular way of communication. In fact, there are many, many people who don't communicate very well on a verbal level, but can communicate either on a dance level, on a movement level, on a drawing level, on a sign language level, on all kinds of levels, in ways that draw from them what they're trying to communicate, which go way beyond the just talking. And so in all our workshops, we make it possible for people to communicate with us and with each other in ways which are nonverbal, which get at deeper levels of human endeavor. that or human communication. As you know, when young children are raised, some of the most important ways that parents and grandparents can communicate with them are not through words, but through their feelings, through their touching, through their attitudes. And that's what we're trying to achieve also in these workshops. And so what you see on these lines of people writing, what they're doing is either writing something about how they feel about it, or they're making drawings, or they're communicating in different ways, and then they put them up on the wall and use those as a way of telling other people in the workshop what they feel and what they'd like to have happen. And then also there are other ways too. Sometimes in Alcatraz and in other workshops, small theater groups have actually put on little plays that tell about what they want to have happen. These are all methods of giving people opportunities to communicate with each other in a deeply right brain way rather than always on a left brain way, that is, intuitively, emotionally, empathetically.
Do these people then create ideas that you're able to incorporate in their work, or is it just allowing them to feel a part of the planning process?
No. It does both, of course. When you have contributed, you do feel part of things, but that is a very important byproduct. But the real reason for these workshops is the contribution of ideas, and the ideas can go as deeply or as shallowly or as surfacely as people want. They can leave it just, we would like to have such and such a facility, which is fairly simple. Or they can go deeper and say, we would like it to look like this, or we would like it to feel like this, or when we're inside of it, we would like to be able to do this. So that the level of contribution is as deep as people can make it. And we try in our workshops to make that depth of communication as deep as possible. So yes, it's not only to get them to feel part of it and committed to it, but the actual ideas very often come from the workshops.
You're just now recovering from a hip replacement and you have a limited walking range while you're recuperating. How does this affect your sense of mobility and moving within a space, how other people who might be also physically challenged will react? Is this changing your attitude as an urban planner?
I think what it's changed mostly is my understanding of dependency. It's something that I haven't quite coped with yet, because I'm not over it yet. I can't put on my own socks, for example, or my own underwear. I depend on my wife to do that, and she giggles all the time in the morning because she said, boy, you really don't like this, do you? The sense of dependency has not been something that I've, on somebody else, has not been something that I've understood. I've also had to have people drive me around. I have found it difficult, and it's made it more understandable to me how other people who are handicapped or disabled, as they prefer to be known as, how they must feel. And that I'm glad for this experience. I haven't sorted out yet what this sense of dependency means for me, but I do know that I want to get over it as quickly as possible, and therefore my friends who have been permanently disabled, I understand how deeply and desperately they want the sense of independent ability to cope with their own life, even on a limited basis. In addition to that, of course, I did do a study in a movie about the relationship of disabled people to their environment, which is available for use. I had, through workshops with disabled people, had a sense of understanding of this relationship. But now it's more as usual. When you experience something on your own and it's not intellectual, you really learn more about it, and that's how I feel right now.
Do you go back to any of your sites and just sort of hang out, lean against the wall, and watch how people are using it? You converted the Ghirardelli Chocolate Factory on San Francisco Bay into the Ghirardelli Center, now filled with shops and restaurants, multi-layers, parking garage underneath, one of the great urban redevelopment projects of the early 60s. Do you go back and just hang out and watch how people use it?
Sure, I do that. I haven't done that with Ghirardelli for a while now, but I try as often as possible to go back and sit and look and enjoy.
What pleases you most when you you know.
Oh, when, it's very simple. What pleases me most,
drive.
if I sit there and watch people enjoy themselves, and people of all ages, and if I can see people sitting in the sun and talking with each other, children playing in the water, if I can feel events happening, as at the Embarcadero, the great plaza there that we did, I enjoy enormously watching all the events that happen there, all the people who use it. At Levi Strauss, I enjoy people's sense of being in nature. In fact, one of the great things that people said to me a couple of months ago is what we enjoy so much is that you've brought the dragonflies back into the city and the birds. Sure, I enjoy very much watching that happen. I think it's also true, however, that inevitably I'm forward-oriented rather than backward-oriented, and what I enjoy most is the drawings and models and other things that I'm making for some of the newer projects.